Our first cases are numbers 22-1417 and 22-1484, Lawntex versus Nike. Mr. Panikowski?
Thank you and good morning, Your Honors. Stanley Panikowski for the appellant and cross-appellee, Nike, Inc. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Granted.
Thank you. Unless the court steers me elsewhere, I plan to address three issues: fair use, willfulness, and the exceptional case ruling. And if the court rules for Nike on fair use, then it need not reach any other issues in the appeals. First, Nike's use of the words cool, compression, merely to describe features of its products was fair use as a matter of law. Just like in the Seventh Circuit's Sport Fuel case and the Second Circuit's cosmetically sealed case, the undisputed facts established each element of this defense. The district court's denial of judgment as a matter of law was based on the good faith element, but that decision cannot be reconciled with the correct legal standard for good faith under this court's precedent.
What is there an argument that you used this as a trademark? Because you have these other kinds, you have dry fit, you have hyper warm. Is it possible that cool compression is just using this as a trademark?
No, Your Honor, that wouldn't be a reasonable inference from the record, because when you look at the case law and all of the factors that would be indicia of trademark use, none of those are present here. You don't see the use of cool compression on any products, labels, hang tags, packaging. It's not featured in any advertising campaigns or retail store displays. And that stands in stark contrast with a term like dry fit, which, as the record shows, was used on products.
Well, you owned dry fit.
Correct, Your Honor.
You didn't own cool compression.
Correct, Your Honor. But this,
why would you put cool compression on all your products when you didn't own it?
Your Honor, because as the record uniformly showed, Nike used the words cool and warm to describe thermoregulatory features of its products, and the words cool, the words compression and fitted to then describe the tightness of the fit. And the Supreme Court has explained in KP Permanent that the fair use defense is important because a trademark owner, even with an incontestable registered trademark, cannot have a monopoly on the descriptive use of these descriptive terms.
I mean, if they just said cool or if they just said compression, fair, but they're combining the two, sometimes directly, sometimes with words in the middle, sometimes everything else like this. But when you combine the two, doesn't that begin to take you outside of what the Supreme Court said? Were those cases dealing with the combination of terms, or were they dealing with one term in isolation?
Your Honor, most of these cases are dealing with a phrase or a combination of terms. For example, love potion in the dessert beauty case that the Second Circuit summarily affirmed. You also have seal with a kiss and cosmetically sealed in sport fuel. You actually have Gatorade admitting that they used Gatorade, the sports fuel company, as a rebranding effort and as a slogan in an advertising campaign. And even there, Your Honors, the Seventh Circuit said, as a matter of law, that is not a trademark use. You do not even have any fact like that here. All that Lawntex points to, as Your Honors noted, is the presence of cool and compression next to each other in the Nike Pro product style names. And the record, again, shows without
a good branding technique, right? I mean, the people that brand the Nike products aren't novices, and it was a catchy phrase, and it helped sell a lot of product. It was put in the tech sheets. There was training on it. There was testimony from Nike employees that they were encouraged to sell the product that way. I think there was testimony from retail folks that were trained on it, right? So it's not accidental. It's all very intentional.
No, Your Honor, there's no evidence of that. That would just be based on speculation. There's no evidence Nike promoted or encouraged anyone else to promote cool compression as a trademark.
There wasn't testimony in the record that they were trained to use cool and compression together?
No, Your Honor, not outside the context of the entire style name with Nike Pro. There was evidence that showed that.
Well, I didn't say it had to be outside the style name Nike Pro.
Right. So Your Honor.
Are you suggesting that it's as long as Nike Pro is attached to Cool Compression that solves your problem?
Your Honor, in these circumstances, and as this court has recognized in the case law, the presence of the Nike Pro house marks at the beginning of the style name is a significant factor that ameliorates that. The Second Circuit and Seventh Circuit also recognize that. But Your Honor,
it can help you on likelihood of confusion, certainly.
Your Honor,
if somebody sees the Swoosh or the Jumpman and Cool Compression, there's a decent chance they're going to think it's a Nike product because those brands are emblematic. I mean, those logos, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. And it is also a strong indicia of non-trademark use, as the Seventh and Second Circuit have recognized. And here we have
I don't understand that sort of aggregation theory. I mean, that's like saying that, you know, as long as you put Life Water in front of Gatorade, you're not infringing upon Gatorade. I mean, once you put the word Gatorade with Life Water, you're infringing on it. So too here, once you add Cool Compression to Nike Pro or Dry Fit, you know, you're using something that belongs to somebody else, according to the trademark office.
Your Honor, that type of per se rule is not the law. And again, in cases like Sport Fuel and Dessert Beauty, the alleged trademark was used in the name of the product. Yet in those cases, the court said that this is a fair use as a matter of law. And so when we go back to the style names, Your Honor, what we have here is a uniform record that shows that, and you see this from the exhibits that plaintiff itself has put in the record, the supplemental appendix, page 146, 222, about how Nike names its products. And what you see from that and from also appendix pages 2594, 2595, is that you have various components of the style name, and one of them would describe material.
So just to maybe pick up on a combination of what you're saying, sorry for interrupting, and what Judge Hardiman asked, is what if Lontex decided that it wanted to market something called Cool Compression Dry Fit? And so what happens is, under your theory of fair use, we could say, okay, cool descriptor, compression descriptor, dry descriptor, fit descriptor. Maybe it's because dry is DRI or you know, some other thing like that. But it feels like you could say, hey, anytime we have true descriptors, no matter how big the collage is, we're going to fall into fair use as a matter of law because they're not used as a trademark. They're merely to describe the product. And then we get into the one point that you kind of haven't touched on, which was central, which is good faith. I don't know where your thoughts are on good faith. I don't know where your thoughts are on this dry fit hypothetical. It's not the greatest hypothetical because dry is spelled different. I think it's DRI. And so it's spelled right, differently, but yeah.
And Your Honor, if I may address both those
points. Oh, yeah, please unpack it however you want, at least from purposes of me, maybe not.
Thank you, Your Honor. So with Dry Fit, as Your Honor indicated, there are legions of differences, beginning with the fact that you have spelled as DRI-fit. And in those circumstances, Your Honor, the issue isn't whether looking at the style name alone allows you to determine whether there is a non-trademark use as a matter of law. You have to look at the entire record, particularly the objective evidence, because the Supreme Court said in KP Permanent, the inquiry is, was the use objectively fair? And it's compatible with a certain degree of consumer confusion, which again, we argue was not present here as a matter of law. But even if some consumers were to look at the style name and have some confusion based on that, you look at everything else that the defendant has done.
So if it was Cool Compression DRY no hyphen fit, you would say fair use by Lontex?
Your Honor, we would need to know a lot more facts.
I'm not going to admit that now because Lontex would have a field day with that.
But
it seems like if the protection inures to your trademark, you know, it would probably work for Cool Compression, too.
And Your Honor, this is where it's important then to open up the entire field of vision to look at all of the other indicia of trademark, non-trademark use that the courts have recognized and say, okay, well, is the defendant putting it on products, labels, hang tags, packages? Are they promoting it as a trademark? Is it featured in an advertising campaign? Is it featured in retail store displays? And with respect to the use of cool compression here, but, we don't have any of that evidence in the record.
So I get that those are the traditional ways of doing it, but you know, Lantex had its kind of own kind of unique market, right? It small budget, calls taken on the cell phone, but it kind of a very personal way of doing it. And so if Nike's way of using cool compression is more akin to Lantex's way of cool compression, that is not putting on products, not doing things like this, doesn't that kind of show that at least for Lantex's marketing methods, Nike's doing something a little closer instead of the full barrage of things that not even Lantex is doing?
Mm-hmm. No, Your Honor. So first, Lantex's failure to do those things are all indicative of the weakness of its trademark.
That's LAP, right? That's LAP 2 or something like that. Yeah.
Correct, Your Honor. Yeah. But even so, you do need to look at whether the defendant is doing any of these other things in order to see, are they making a trademark use? And the use that is accused here, which is the appearance of the two words next to each other in the Nike product style names almost exclusively online, that's not even a use that Lantex was making of the terms. So even under the terms of that hypothetical, Your Honor, there's a big distinction. And on good faith, which also relates to the legally improper willfulness verdict and the error on the intent factor for likelihood of confusion, what we had here, Your Honors, is a uniform record, not just witness testimony, but the documents in the record showing that cool and warm were used as material modifiers. And then compression and fitted were used to describe the tightness of the fit. And all of that established Nike's good faith. And in response to that, Lantex actually has made it easy for this court in reviewing this decision under a judgment as a matter of law standard, because Lantex pointed only to two facts to try to negate good faith. The same two facts that they used exclusively to try to support willfulness, which were the lack of a trademark clearance search, and then the lack of immediate cessation in response to Lantex's cease and desist letter.
After counsel said there was a problem. Your in-house counsel said there was a problem.
No, Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record that Nike's in-house counsel said that there was a problem. That's Lantex's assertion in their brief.
Didn't one of Nike's lawyers say to instruct cessation of use of cool compression?
So yes, Your Honor, the latter, Nike's in-house counsel did instruct cessation. However, Nike's in-house counsel did not, there's no evidence in the record, Your Honor, that Nike's in-house counsel said that there is a problem.
No, I'm making the what I believe to be not so substantial leap in logic that when in-house counsel says stop doing something, it stands to reason that it's because there's a problem or a potential problem. What evidence do you have in the record that Nike's legal department believed that its use of cool compression was in fact fair use?
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, in the trial record, there is
what page?
So, Your Honor, I was going to say that in the trial record, there is nothing that describes...
No evidence of fair use.
...that describes Nike's legal counsel's opinions. What we actually have here, Your Honor, is far better, which is the consistent testimony of all...
What page? I'm looking for citations and statements.
Right.
Not generalized descriptions.
Yes.
What evidence in the record is there that Nike... believed it was engaging in fair use? You've already said there was no evidence of the legal department believing fair use, and you concede that fair use is a legal term of art in this case, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so yeah. What do you have if you don't have legal department?
So, Your Honor, we have testimony from Nike witnesses at pages, for example, 11, 14, and 15, 11, 67, 11, 87.
Can you go through some of those?
Sure. And Your Honor, what... Would you like the numbers, or would you like me to describe?
If you could quote, I'm going to pull up the pages. You said 11, 14, 16.
11, 14 to 15.
15, okay.
11, 67.
So let's start with that. 11, 14 is appendix 4, is it? Or, let's see.
And so, Your Honor, and all of these citations, which are also in the briefs on fair use and also on willfulness and intent, these are all establishing two facts. One, that Nike was using the words cool and warm to describe properties of the materials used in the products.
So just quote for me the language that indicates that Nike's use of the phrase cool compression constituted fair use.
Yes, Your Honor. So on page 1114, Ms. Ireland, a Nike employee, is explaining at line 5. So base layer would come in a few fits. There would be a compression fit, which is like the tightest fit closest to your body. Then we also had a tight fit or a fitted fit. That is a little bit looser than the compression, but still form fitting to the body. And then Ms. Ireland goes on to talk about silhouettes, talks about the marketing of the products, and that Nike would put Nike Pro on products, on inside labels, and on hang tags. And the evidence, including the physical exhibits that this court has, shows that
is the cool phrase compression, cool compression mentioned on 1114?
No, Your Honor, and that's because.
Okay, so where do you have evidence that cool compression, that phrase, that somebody at Nike thought it was fair use?
So, Your Honor, there's not evidence where any of these lay witnesses are drawing a legal conclusion that it's fair use. What these witnesses are testifying to is Nike's intent to use these terms only to describe these features of the product.
Doesn't use, you mentioned silhouette, you mentioned all kinds of things, but you didn't mention cool compression. Where,
right.
Where do the lay witnesses say cool compression is
right.
fair use? They don't.
Right. And that proves, Your Honor, why this record is uniform in showing that Nike was only using the terms cool and warm and then compression and fitted in a descriptive way.
So I guess my thought on that is, you know, on the good faith area, I get it. You've got some evidence that some people at Nike thought, hey, look, we're just using this descriptively. We don't have a problem with this. But I don't know that that's the entire record. Because and for you to win, you have to kind of say, look, the record is unequivocal on this, at least as I understand the standard, because there's other evidence, length of time for which the infringing took place, the cease and desist letter, the statements from in-house counsel. And so when we want to look at good faith, if we put all those pieces together, why isn't that a factual determination as opposed to one that we can just say, I think you've got good evidence that there was good faith there. I don't know that the only evidence is that there was good faith and that the only conclusion that must be compelled is that there's good faith. And so if there's some degree of contrary evidence, then I don't know that you can take you see right. my point? Like you've got to show not only that you've got good evidence,
yes,
but
sir,
there's no other evidence, and this is the only conclusion that can be drawn. And Judge Hardiman was kind of teasing out, hey, aren't there other pieces of evidence here that, you know, might color that determination?
And no, there is not, Your Honor. And I think that, as you're pointing out, it starts with the legal standard. So this court in Institute for Scientific Information set out the legal standard for good faith and fair use, and that is whether the defendant intended to trade upon or dilute the goodwill of the trademark owner. And then you take the JMAL standard, which this court in Walter versus Holiday Inn said, it's not whether there's literally no evidence to support the non-moving party's position. It's whether, is there enough evidence here that could properly support the jury's verdict? Can you draw that reasonable inference? And here, Lontex has made it easy because, Your Honor, there is no contrary evidence that would show under the legal standard that Nike intended to trade upon or dilute Lontex's goodwill. Rather, they point only to two facts that this court in Securicom in the willfulness context, as well as this court in the intent context and other courts directly in the good faith context for fair use have said are legally insufficient. And you see this at pages 1519 to 21 of the record where counsel is delivering the closing argument about willfulness. And for all of these intent-related issues, points only to two facts. One, no trademark clearance search, and then two, no immediate cessation. And then the evidence also shows that Nike did take steps directly in response to the cease and desist letter.
So I guess just press this a little bit.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if there was only one fact, no trademark search, we would probably say we got case law that says that's just not enough to get the deliberateness, that's just not enough to get the willfulness, that's not it. If there was only one fact which says, hey, you didn't cease in response to a cease and desist letter, even for a period of 2 years, we might look to some case law and say, oh, in isolation, that's not enough either. But they do have two facts, and they're trying to, you know, take them in aggregate, couple them, put them together, and say, hey, does that now rise to the level? Those two in combination? I get divide and conquer works for you, but what about the combo?
Right. Your Honor, this court has already addressed a case where those two facts were present, and that is Securicom, where in the willfulness context, the court had both the lack of a trademark search and the failure to cease immediately in response to a cease and desist letter. You also had that in the Dessert Beauty case, directly about good faith and fair use, where you had both of those facts. And in both of those cases, the court said, this just isn't enough from which one can reasonably infer some sort of intent to confuse or some sort of intent to trade upon or dilute the goodwill of the markholder. At most, these facts may be consistent with carelessness, and but
so,
is this court...
So can we add in this kind of third fact of the advice from legal counsel to see to quit using the cool compression? I mean, isn't that kind of fact three? And if that is fact three, doesn't that take you outside of Securicom?
Your Honor, that wouldn't be the third fact. That would actually be something that undercuts the force of the second fact on which Lantex relies. So we have two problems with their reliance on the lack of immediate cessation. First and most important here, that is insufficient as a matter of law, even when you combine it with the lack of a trademark clearance search. And then, Your Honor, it's also factually flawed, because even though Lantex has repeatedly said throughout their briefs that Nike did nothing because it thought that it was able to get away with just pure speculation and innuendo, the facts actually show that Nike did take steps and took steps immediately, where they went ahead and they made sure that Cool and Compression were separated from each other on all pages on Nike.com, not just some of them. They took steps to make sure that words would no longer appear next to each other in wholesale catalogs. It did take some time for those updates to happen, and those catalogs are...
Were they ever removed from text sheets?
Your Honor, there's no... There was in the record testimony that all of the relevant Nike partners were informed of the need to separate
Nike ever remove Cool Compression from the text sheets?
Your Honor, I would need to check the record and see if there was any specific testimony saying that, you know, it was confirmed that they were removed from the text sheets, but there is testimony that there were instructions that were given to everyone.
Can you point us to any evidence in the record where Nike removed Cool Compression from the text sheets?
Your Honor, not at this moment.
Okay, thank you. All right. You've gone quite a bit over. You still have plenty of time on rebuttal.
Yes, so. Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Setlin.
Setlin, thank you, Your Honor. Misha Setlin for Lantex. I'll talk a little bit about good faith, and that also interacts with willfulness, but I would appreciate the opportunity to talk about our cross appeal as well. Once I get through that, I guess we'll see how it goes. With regard to good faith and willfulness, as was already explored a little bit by this panel, what happened is, as of 2016, it was undisputed that they knew about our registered, incontestable trademark. And yet they did nothing, absolutely nothing, in their most important sales channel, which is the third-party retailer where most of us buy Nike, you know, Dick's Sporting Goods, Walmart, et cetera, to get them to stop using what their own counsel told them
to do.
Well,
they eventually stopped using it.
It took them
to. It just took a while. And, I mean, this is not a small, nimble company like your client's company, so it takes a while for these things to... changes to be made, right?
There's no evidence that it was working through its way through Nike bureaucracy for 2 years. I mean, what I think the fairest inference from the trial record, and certainly one that the jury could draw, is, you know, to quote the Securicom case that my friend referenced, there was an aura of indifference. They got this instruction from counsel, said it was instructed them to stop using cool compression. They did some things on the website, and then they just didn't bother with the tech sheets, the all-important tech sheets, just how the retailers know how to brand the Nike products or the catalogs. Did nothing for 2 years. That, I think the fairest inference from that is that it's an aura of indifference, but certainly that's a permissible inference, and that's enough by itself to negate any assertion of good faith or...
Let me just tease out on that. Let's just say that any jurist in the world, anyone in the world would say, you know what, they meet the first two criteria for fair use. Cool compression meets it. They're not using it as trademark, and they're merely using it to describe its product. Let's just say that, hypothetical, right? I know you got issues with that, but let's just say that's the case. And then Nike says, hey, we're in the heartland of fair use right now. So we're in total good faith if we continue to use it. Can't good faith be continued use when you know to a certainty that you meet the first two criteria? Or do you still have to sit there and say, oh, well, we should stop, even though we think we meet to a certainty the first two criteria? What do you think?
Well, good faith and willfulness are subjective inquiries. So you have to do an inquiry. Was it fair for a jury to determine that it wasn't done by Nike for that reason? And I think the fairest inference, certainly a possible inference, when you have a direction from the legal department, say stop, you stop on the website, but you don't stop in the most important stuff, is you just don't care. You think this is a small fry, this is a gnat, we're not gonna bother. Not that we think our legal department is wrong and we're gonna keep doing it, but we just don't care. I think if they had gotten this instruction from the legal department and said, stop this because this is an Adidas registered incontestable trademark, this is a Reebok incontestable trademark, you can bet your bottom dollar it would have been out of those tech sheets within days. It wouldn't have taken 2 years to get out of the tech sheets. And I think that's clearly what happened. I think that's by far the fairest inference, but it's certainly a possible inference from the jury to draw. And once it's concluded, that's a possible inference for the jury to draw. That knocks out the good faith defense. That knocks out all the willfulness arguments. And then all we're left with is the laugh factors. They don't point to a single decision, any appellate decision overturning a jury verdict of confusion on the laugh factors. So I think that disposes of their entire appeal. So then...
What about the attorney's fees point? As I looked at this, I saw that, you know, attorney's fees were a multiplier of actual of damages. Damages were in the 700,000 range. Attorney's fees were in kind of the 5 million, high 4 million range. And so why is this the sort of case that would get that would trigger fee shifting? Is it just because of willfulness again?
Well, certainly the district court here pointed to willfulness, and under this court's decision of Fairwind, that's an important factor. Again, they don't point to a single decision anywhere in the country where there was a willfulness finding, and a district court exercises broad discretion to award attorney's fees, and an appellate court.
The problem is one is collapsing into the other. We're sort of back to where we started, which is I hear you reading the Lanham Act's affirmative defense in sort of parsing out the elements. But as I see the statute, it's basically a holistic determination. We don't look and say, was it used as a trademark? Check. Was it used in good faith? Check. What we're doing is saying, hey, was this used in a way that is not part of the protections that Congress sought to impose in the Lanham Act? And so to Judge Phipps's point, it seems like once you start saying, again, and I know you'll disagree, but if hypothetically we said, well, it's not being used as a trademark because it's not being used descriptively, we start to move into that infects that affects our way of thinking about what a defendant's actions were relative to remedying the allegation of unfair use. And so the delay starts to seem perhaps less onerous. It seems, as a matter of law, more likely reasonable. But you have to, I think, take the other argument, which is, no, we have to separate these things out. in order to find an individual term of willfulness, and then that's what's going to support the damages award as well as the attorney's fees, right?
Well, I apologize. If Your Honors were talking, Your Honor was talking about the good faith defense, certainly I don't think there's a dispute that those are three elements. It has to be good faith, subjectively good faith. It's not like the laugh factors where you could ignore one factor. But with regard to attorney's fees, you already have, you know, that's at the end of the ballgame. You already have the jury verdict and, you know, and
but the legal standard's exceptional, correct?
That's right, Your Honor.
And it's abuse of discretion review, so we show some deference to the trial court. But the trial court has to make a finding that this case is exceptional.
Yes, Your Honor.
And like my colleagues, I'm concerned about the notion that willfulness suffices to make a case exceptional.
Certainly.
Because to me, those are two different things. I mean, here, the judge explained his willfulness finding, which resulted in the trebling of the damages. But it seemed like the explanation on attorney's fees was a little thin. I mean, I read the trial transcript, 10-day trial, hard fought, very well lawyered by both sides. Seemed rather routine for me. It didn't seem very exceptional.
Well, it's certainly, I mean, willfulness, it's, I mean, even if a trial judge has the discretion not to award attorney's fees in a willfulness case, I mean, this court in Fairwind suggested that willfulness is an important consideration.
But so
okay, but why is it enough, though?
Well, so
I mean, and weren't some of the considerations not proper? Because some of the considerations seem to be just strong policy considerations, David versus Goliath. You know, is it the case that anytime a small company challenges a big company, that if they prevail, even in a modest verdict like this, that you're going to be able to back up the truck and get millions of dollars in attorney's fees?
Well, a couple of things, Your Honor. First, as I read Octane Fitness, including footnote 6, it's an all things considered inquiry. So these, you know, while certainly
totality, I'm with you on that.
Yeah, and
it's
so
totality.
We're talking about totality, and I think that this notion of the big attorney's fees versus small damage actually supports what the district court was doing, because in order to bring a case like this against a big company, there's no challenge here. The $5 million was spent was too much.
I'm not saying your fees were too high.
It's
just saying
discretion to award them at all, when at least I read Octane Fitness is saying the number one thing we're looking at is strength of case.
Right.
And I'm not sure that you can say that this is just absolutely hands down the strongest case you'll ever see, or is extraordinarily strong, such that if there's a Bell distribution that you're at the sweet spot of the curve either.
So I think
building on that, where did the district court make that find?
So I think that, well, so the finding is on JA 41 through 42, but I think that the reading the word strength of case there in isolation, I think, is misleading. And as this court, I think, clarified in Fairwind, what the strength of case means is how bad was the misconduct, not was it that we were entitled to?
I thought Fairwind talked about two different, but two. I thought it bifurcated. Say there's two ways you can meet the red Octane Fitness. Yeah. Say there's two ways: how you litigate, and then how strong things are. And I'm focused not on the how you litigate part, but the how strong of a case, because people litigate in you know, unfortunate ways, and that's going to get fees. But this case isn't about unfortunate litigation. It's about strength of case. And I guess what I'm saying is,
do you agree with that? Do you agree that this isn't something about the litigation tactics?
Absolutely. But strength of case, Your Honor. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no. But so I guess my thought is, if we're supposed to be looking at strength of case, and maybe a little more holistically, I'll spot you a little of that. But I don't know that we can inject any policy reason whatsoever from deviating from the American rule into that consideration. If we sit there and say, hey, it's David versus Goliath, I think it's a good policy to encourage this, especially in the trademark use area, those feel like policy justifications are getting kind of far away from just a standard strength of case.
So just focusing just on strength of case as such and putting aside the very important policy considerations that I do think are permissible under footnote 6 of Octane Fitness. The strength of case doesn't go to whether, you know, we were entitled to summary judgment or something. That is how bad was the misconduct that the jury found. Strength of case is, I think.
And I mean, honestly, like, you know, that's a weird one, because the award wasn't particularly huge. And the punitive damages, there were punitive damages, but I don't think there were punitive damages that would throttle a company like Nike in the least. I mean,
that's true. However, the misconduct that was found here was willful, which is, I think, an important consideration.
So the outrage meter had to be very low for it to be $365,000.
I mean, maybe so, although obviously the U.S. Supreme Court has held that, you know, multiples of certain amount are even violating due process. So maybe, you know, maybe the jury, you know, wasn't familiar with BMW, but it was familiar with those kind of factors. But it isn't ultimately the jury's decision on attorney's fees. It's the judge's independent decision. And in fact, I think it might be problematic if the judge was kind of outsourcing that exceptional case inquiry through a reading of punitive damages to the jury.
But I guess that's what I'm coming at with. In the civil rights context, there's a really, really, really kind of a willingness by Congress to transfer fees, because it says even a disabled person was denied access to the library for 1 hour, you know, we want them to vindicate their concern and we'll engage in fee shifting. So if they win it all, they get fees.
Prevailing party
standard. Here, it's not the prevailing party standard. Just winning isn't good enough. It seems that we have to look at other things. And if we're looking at other things, it just strikes me as, man, $5 million is a lot to get.
I understand, for
something that went to a jury trial and seems that at least some of the elements of fair use are met, some of the lap factor, people can argue whatever they want on the lap factor.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, on the $5 million, the pure number of how much it is, I think has to play no role in the analysis. That's a whether.
You're saying that fees either, it's a binary. Fees are either appropriate because the case is exceptional, or if the case is not exceptional, fees are not appropriate. And then the only consideration is, were the timesheets justified?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Although I do think the $5 million actually kind of points in the direction, points to, you know, the notion that if Your Honor's hold as a matter of law, that even a showing of willfulness against a major corporation like this is not sufficient for attorney's fees.
And the willfulness, again, you're referencing back here to the failure to conduct the trademark search and then the delay in intervening.
Yeah, yeah. And the second thing, I want to just highlight that more.
Is that the willfulness?
Yeah, especially that.
Satisfies both, that defeats the fair use defense, it helps show your Lanham Act affirmative claim, and then it justifies the exceptional circumstances.
You're
not going to get attorney's fees on a Lanham Act case that you win on, then, right?
Well, if you don't have willfulness, then
you're not going to win the case.
No, that's not true, Your Honor.
The fair use defense is going to come up in most everything. So I would assume you could have bad faith under the Lanham Act affirmative defense, but you couldn't, but might not be willful, and therefore
the good faith defense is often not even an issue in cases. Now, usually in trademark cases, if you get a win, you get it on lap factors. It's rare that you get a willfulness win. That's a rare circumstance. And I'm not saying that always leads to attorney's fees, but that's a good reason to let the district court, who actually sat the jury, who sat at the trial and who's given the initial discretion of wide berth. And I think it's telling.
We've got to look at his reasons, though, too, right? Well, I agree with you about deference here. It's a relatively deferential standard of review, but you pointed us to Appendix 42, and Paragraph 3, the court said, if damages from Nike would not fully compensate plaintiff, the award of attorney's fees will help do so. Because otherwise, Lawntex with itself would have to pay its attorneys. It's not realistic to expect a small firm like Lawntex to be able to pay the legal bills to a major law firm for this type of case. That strongly suggests that if you were representing Adidas or Under Armour, that fees would not be awarded.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, that's certainly not, I think that's an additional consideration, but I think It is just true that they have not cited a single appellate case.
But is that a valid consideration? Stick with me on this, though. Is that a valid consideration? I'm questioning whether that's valid. Because to me, I don't know if I can accept the premise that whether or not a case is exceptional will be dictated by the relative size of the litigants. And I'm happy to be persuaded. If you can persuade me why that should be part of the exceptional calculus, I'm happy to hear from you and Mr. Panikowski on that. But I'm questioning that.
Okay, so I kind of have three responses I'd like to give. First, I do think it's a relevant consideration because it is part of an all things considered judgment, and footnote 6 of Octane Fitness says it's an all things considered judgment.
Second, if the universe applies, if you had a great substantive gap between the strengths of the cases, then it wouldn't matter. The size of the entities wouldn't matter. So you can't get attorney's fees if you're a big firm.
No, I don't think that's right. That wouldn't, that wouldn't forward any sort of legitimate.
Like a sliding scale between like how big a company you are and how strong a case you have.
I mean, there's certainly, a resistance in some judges to failure to have bright line rules, Justice Scalia, the law of rules, et cetera, that you all know. But it is an all things considered inquiry. And this is one of the criticisms of all things considered inquiries, is you can then importing a lot of considerations. But if Your Honor just does not agree,
they're all factual considerations. It's a totality of factual considerations, not laying in policy overtones and then saying these facts help a policy consideration. It was, I think, facts designed to show that it's an exceptional case, not who the parties were to the case. And at least I read it as the buzzword is strength of case. It's all things considered for strength of case, not for other policy considerations that aren't related to the claims or defenses in a case, such as the identity of the parties.
So, Your Honor, I mean, I just really want to make the following point. If Your Honors disagree with me that that's a permissible consideration, then and I think it is a permissible consideration. I think there's no case ruling it out. The proper disposition in that sort of circumstance would be to make clear to Judge Bailson that he can't use his consideration and send it back for re-evaluation.
I was going to ask you about remand is a possibility here.
Yeah,
right?
Certainly.
It's possible that the record could support a finding of exceptional case, but what we have here in terms of justification doesn't cut the mustard.
I mean, I think that, you're not, I think there's a lot of case law saying you're not, in an abuse of discretion review, you're not supposed to grade the district court's work, but if your honors think that, and so I don't think that the explanation is not fulsome enough on strength of argument but if you think that particular factor, the David of Goliath, was legally improper, and I disagree with Lou, then I think you send it back to the district judge and say, don't look at David and Goliath, but I don't think that, just for administrability and other areas of law, you should say that you didn't say enough words, and so we're not going to do the kind of, and I see I'm out of time, unfortunately.
So really, a remand would only be appropriate if we find that one of his articulated considerations was an improper one.
Was legally improper under, Octane Fitness, including footnote
right,
6.
But you're emphasizing that it's a totality of the circumstances approach, and that's flexible. And
yeah, and I do think it is telling that they do not point to a single district court, a single appellate decision anywhere in the nation overturning an attorney's.
Well, do you have any cases like this where there was $142,000 in royalties and $365,000 in punitives, and then attorney's fees were awarded? And it was, do you have other cases that were affirmed where the attorney's fees dwarfed the jury verdict like this in this case?
No, but because that's not a relevant factor. The amount of attorney's fees, as Your Honor noted, is...
Even if it's binary, though, I think maybe just Judge Hardiman's question is, don't do the comparative part. Just say, when your takeaway was this kind of small for how big it could have been, do we then see an award of attorney's fees? I think he's asking, do you have a case where you're taking home, considering what you could have taken home and considering what you probably hope to take home, you're taking home much, much, much less in the way of damages than you probably were hoping, your client was probably hoping for. Do you see attorney's fees in those instances?
I mean, that would involve going into the complaints of cases and seeing what, a lot of times folks are asking for $80 million.
What's the best case then for where the totality of the circumstances were similar to the circumstances here
and it was found to be exceptional. Because I think that's I'll agree with you. I mean, it doesn't, let's assume the amount of the award doesn't matter, that it is binary. But it has to still be, what's the legal standard for the totality of circumstances, which it seems like Octane and we have said looks at the substantive strength of the case and then litigation conduct. We took that second part out, so we're in the substantive strength of the case, which I'm not seeing something analogous to here where you say it was litigated, the jury made a finding, but it's not, the district court isn't making a finding that says there was no reasonable defense here.
No, I think this is an important distinction on strength of case. What Fairwind says, and what this court cases before Octane Fitness looked at, is the fact that there is willfulness. Even if willfulness is a close call or not, if there is willfulness, that itself makes the case strong in a different way. Not strong, and
it allows you to get disgorgement, right? It allows you to disgorge profits if you could show willfulness and things like that, right?
Well, I mean, I'd obviously hope to be able to cover our cross appeal. We had two cross appeal issues.
The statute says a willful violation of the case allows you to get, among other things, defendant's profits, damages sustained by the plaintiff, right? And then it says at the end, the court in exceptional cases may award a reasonable attorney's fee. Yeah. So why wouldn't, I mean, I think what you're saying is willfulness just does the whole thing. If you have willfulness, then it is an exceptional case, but then why would you need that clause at the end that says, and why would you add an exceptional case at all? You would just say an attorney's fee.
Well, willfulness is not earlier mentioned in 117A, so the fact that there is willfulness certainly is sufficient to put it within the ambient of a district court's discretion. And there is no case anywhere in the country saying that a district court committed reversible error for granting attorney's fees where there was willfulness.
It is mentioned earlier in 117A. The exceptional fee is the last part of 117, but before that is discussion about profits, damages, and
costs. Yeah, and so if Your Honor,
those have to be willful, but then it says exceptional. So I think you could just tuck attorney's fees into the first part of 117A if it was all supposed to be about willfulness. It seems the more natural reading is the one Octane and Fairwind give, which is, look, this is about overall substantive strength of the case. And what the district court here did, I think we agree, was not look at it through that lens. It applied an alternative test, which I understand you to argue is the same as the totality of the circumstance, and maybe that's where our disagreement.
I don't think even my friends argue that willfulness, that a finding willfulness is not part of that first factor, first path. They say that that's just not enough, and they point to a couple of cases that haven't awarded attorney's fees despite finding willfulness. But if Your Honor, sorry.
I know you want to get to your kind of counterpoints, your counterclaims and stuff like this. Yeah, I'll just give you a quick preview. You're challenging, at least where I am, you're challenging a counterfeiting claim, you know, right? You think the dismissal of counterfeiting was improper?
That's right, Your Honor.
Yeah, but I'll give you a quick hit. When I think a counterfeiting claim, I think of fake purses and fake watches. That's what instantly comes to my head. And so when I'm thinking about this case, I'm thinking to myself, how close is this case to a fake purse or fake watch case? It doesn't strike me as that close. Now the legal standard is kind of a little weird because it says identical or substantially similar. I'm going to botch that, but it's something like that. But I still think of it as really just a fake purse, fake watch case.
Yeah.
So why is this case, I got the legal standard wrong, or why is this case so close to fake purse, fake watches?
Yeah, no, I think that intuition was also my intuition before I came to this case, was probably what was animating Judge Bailson. But, you know, there is a different statute for if you're trafficking in counterfeit goods. You can get thrown in prison for that kind of thing. The statutory text, you know, we're all textualists. The statutory text just says that it has to be an identical or substantially indistinguishable. And that, I think, is why McCarthy on trademark calls it first-class infringement. They're not talking about confusingly similar. If you have a registered trademark and you use an identical version of that. That's all it takes to satisfy the statutory text.
But doesn't that mean a good counterfeiting case would be if Lawntext's garments always use cool compression and Nike's garments used cool compression? And we have the inverse of that here. Lawntext often didn't have it on the garment, at least initially, and I don't see it on any Nike garments.
Well, but so nothing.
It's like counterfeit in the ether.
Nothing in the statutory text requires it to be on the garments in connection with the sale of goods, and they're using.
But to Judge Phipps's point, I mean, you know, if you really want to trick someone into buying a counterfeit garment, you want it to look, feel, say the same things as the real McCoy. And here, and that doesn't even cover the point that the Swoosh and the Jumpman are iconic brands. So you'd have to have been living in a, you know, in a very private cave somewhere not to understand that garments with the swoosh or the Jumpman are Nike goods.
Well, our theory of counterfeiting was that they were using an identical version of our mark to represent to the world that they had the right to use the Lawntext school compression technology. It was a motion to dismiss. That was our theory. So the fact that they put Nike before the counterfeit mark fully supports our theory. It doesn't refute it. And I certainly understand.
Not on the garment, though.
But, I mean, Your Honor, I understand. That was my intuition.
And marketing materials. And
I'm stuck on the fake purse, yeah. fake watch thing. Yeah. This case is really not trying to sell a garment and say, hi, this is actually cool compression, not Nike.
In fact, you've got testimony from at least one, maybe two of your witnesses that really undercut you because it helped you in the other part of the case, in your case in chief, because the testimony went something like, oh, yeah, you know, I went into a store and I saw cool compression, and I think this might have been the trainer for the Phillies or the Eagles. And the response was, oh, I thought maybe you had licensed. I called Mr. Nathan and said, did you license your product to Nike or did you sell it to Nike?
Yeah.
Right. So that's kind of the inverse of counterfeit, isn't it?
Well, again, Your Honor, I understand the sense in which you all are using the words counterfeit. There is a statute that makes it, for example, a criminal violation to traffic in counterfeit goods. The statutory text just requires that the mark be used in commerce that's identical. They use cool compression. It is a registered mark. They used it in commerce. Nothing else is required by the statutory text. So the fact that there is a more colloquial or use of selling counterfeit handbags and things of that sort, which, by the way, is a separate statute, the one involved in Chong Lam, for counterfeit. The reason it is first degree counterfeiting is because you don't need to go through the lab factors. You don't have to have likelihood of confusion. You have just confusingly similar. It's literally the same mark. Now, with regard to the evidence, I actually think that evidence would be consistent with our counting theory. But in any event, this is a motion to dismiss. None of that evidence matters. The question is, did we? And we put a hypothetical in our brief that I think was pretty telling. If some new company arose and put out something that said this is new company, dry fit, dry, D-R-I. Fit. Would that, you know, they put it out, didn't have the Nike Swoosh, but it's like, it's a new company, dry fit, in the registered trademark. I think that would be a legitimate counterfeiting claim, and Nike would be able to prove it up. And we got dismissed at the motion dismiss stage. So, you know, if Your Honor is going to remand for a more fulsome explanation of attorney's fees, I would urge remanding on this and also on disgorgement. I mean, the district court, if you read the remedies opinion, if you read everything in the portion of the opinion that says that we're entitled to enhanced damages, I mean, if you just cross off enhanced damages and put disgorgement, all of that would lead to us getting disgorgement. It's pretty clear that the judge said it at the end of when he was talking about enhanced damages. He said, the reason I'm not doing disgorgement is because the jury has already spoken to the issue. That's not the way you do advisory verdicts. This wasn't a Rule 39C2 where the party is conceded to send the issue of disgorgement to the jury. This was an advisory verdict. So if you're going to send it back on more fulsome explanation of attorney's fees. I think you got to send it back on a more fulsome explanation of disgorgement and how, whether the court would in fact.
So let me just make sure I'm tracing this. So what you're saying is on attorney's fees, if there's reservations that the district court engaged in impermissible considerations, policy considerations at the attorney's fee stage, what you're also saying is the district court engaged in impermissible considerations in rejecting the disgorgement claim?
That's right, Your Honor. I mean, I think the best way to read his opinion is he's saying I'm doing it because the jury has spoken on the issue, and this was not a 39C2. So if you're going to send it back for a more fulsome explanation on attorney's fees, you should send it back for a more fulsome explanation
because,
of disgorgement.
It's not, so the point is it's not permissible to say, look, I'm looking at what the jury did. I'm not going to do just disgorgement based on how they weighed the facts, the verdicts that they gave. I'm just not going to go with disgorgement.
Yeah. I mean, that's the difference between a 39C1 and a 39C2. And I mean, again, if you read the portion of his opinion, I mean, when he talks about why he's enhanced damages, that's the same thing that you would say if you're giving someone a disgorgement. It's all the same words. I mean, he doesn't use, you know, banjo and stuff, but it's just the same stuff. So if he's got to, you know, if he's going to clarify attorney's fees, have him clarify disgorgement. And in clarifying disgorgement, I think it's important, you know, to point out that this court in Marshak held that just the necessity for deterrence itself is a disjunctive reason for disgorgement. You can't reject disgorgement just because you think we're going to get some sort of windfall. If you conclude that this kind of verdict, this small verdict that you said is not going to deter a company in the future from engaging in the willful misconduct that was found here.
Let me, before you sit down, one quick question. Hopefully there's a quick answer, but the district court didn't define recklessness in the jury instructions. Is it problematic or not?
It's not problematic. I mean, that's a term of art that's used. I mean, if you take a look at, you know, what this court said in Securicom, what McCarthy says at 3065, 62. I mean, that's just what the jury instructions are at 1574 through 1576.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Settler. Rebuttal from Mr. Panikowski. Would you mind beginning with an answer to the same question I just asked your friend about definition of recklessness?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court's failure to give a legally correct definition of recklessness is a major problem in this case that not only vitiates willfulness and the remedies that were based on it, but also flowed upstream into fair use and legislative confusion, underscoring why JMAL is appropriate there too. And the reason, Your Honor, why the district court's instruction on willfulness was problematic. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm asking about my understanding is he didn't define recklessness, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Was that a problem or not?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a twofold problem. One, because the district court told the jury that they could find willfulness based on reckless infringement. And that standard is not found in the court's case law. Rather, the court provided the standard in Securicom when the court said, and I quote, Your Honor, knowing or willful infringement consists of more than the accidental encroachment of another's rights. It involves an intent to infringe or a deliberate disregard of a mark holder's rights. The district court didn't instruct the jury on that standard. Moreover, Your Honor, the district court did not apply that standard in considering Nike's motion for judgment as a matter of law on willfulness, as well as on fair use and likelihood of confusion, where the district court simply incorporated its findings on willfulness. And Your Honor, that's a reason why we need judgment as a matter of law on willfulness, because as shown in the Supreme Court's City of St. Louis versus Proprotnick opinion, you need to measure whether there's substantial evidence against the correct legal standard, not against the erroneously instructed legal standard. And so here, if this court has any concerns about setting aside a jury verdict that relates to willfulness good faith intent, those concerns are assuaged not only by the lack of substantial evidence, but by the fact that this jury was laboring under an incorrect instruction from the district court on willfulness. And then even when the jury asked for a definition of good faith, was not given this court's definition from Institute for Scientific Information about intent to confuse or to trade upon or to dilute the mark holder's goodwill. And therefore, Your Honor, the jury did not have the proper legal standard against which to measure the evidence.
So can I just, a little awkward because at least as I understand it, you're supposed to kind of have exchange the parties. Rule 51 says, you know, propose your jury instructions to the parties, you know, before you read them to the jury.
Right, Your Honor.
Yeah. See, it's a rule. But let's just say there was a Rule 51 kind of conference outside the presence of the jury. Like, how big is the gap? Like, what are you saying should have been in there that wasn't in there?
Your Honor, there is...
we don't know because you didn't really object because you didn't really have a great opportunity to object, at least contemporary. Did you? I mean, what's the gap, I guess, is right. The question. It's like, how we want to see how big this is. I'm kind of curious to know what happened. Let's measure what actually occurred versus what you think should have occurred.
Yes, Your Honor. There is a significant substantive gap. So first, we did raise the Rule 51B problem. We nonetheless objected to the willfulness instruction afterward. And then, Your Honor, we also proposed to the court a supplemental instruction on willfulness at docket number 346 that used the 11th Circuit model instruction to convey the same standard from Institute for Scientific Information from this court, intent to trade upon or dilute the goodwill of the mark holder. And that is very significant because merely telling a jury you can find it based on reckless infringement would allow the jury to draw the impermissible inference that Lantex has advocated in this case, to simply look at this and say, well, they didn't perform a trademark clearance search and they didn't immediately stop everything in response to the cease and desist letter, and we think big companies should be more careful than that. The district court's instruction not only permitted that inference, but actually told the jury, you can infer intent from the failure to cease the allegedly infringing conduct.
What's wrong
full
with
stop.
That?
Your Honor, because this court in Securicom has said that you cannot infer willfulness from the failure to yield to a cease and desist letter.
I don't recall in Securicom that counsel advised the cessation. That wasn't a fact in that case, was it?
Your Honor, there isn't a fact there, but once again...
This case, that's a really important difference between that case and this case.
Your Honor, first of all, that's a difference that actually cuts in Nike's favor here because one, Nike's in-house counsel is part of Nike. And therefore, the fact that Nike's in-house counsel said, you know, remove pull and compression from being next to each other in these product style names, that is itself a response. And we also know Your Honor,
That only helps you if it was executed upon forthwith and there was tremendous delay.
So Your Honor, it was executed upon forthwith as Nick Johnson's testimony at pages 23 to 21 and to 23, 26 of the record shows it was executed upon.
In some ways, right away. But in other ways, not at all. It wasn't removed from the tech sheets.
Your Honor, the product style names were changed and the product style names are the input into Nike.com, the wholesale catalogs, the tech sheets. We even heard counsel from Lantex acknowledging that there's no dispute that all of the text sheets were changed, even though we don't have specific testimony in the record. And so what we have here is not inaction in response to the cease and desist letter. And again, the court in Securicom made clear, even if there was inaction in response to the cease and desist letter, that itself cannot be indicative of bad faith.
What's your response to counsel's argument that there are no appellate cases undoing district court awards of attorney's fees after a finding of willfulness?
Your Honor, we didn't cite any such cases in our brief. We have the Federal Circuit in Stryker saying that willfulness does not mandate.
Wasn't my question.
Yes.
He's either right or wrong.
Right. So, Your Honor, we are not aware.
Correct or not?
Correct, Your Honor. We're not aware of any appellate cases that have reversed in those circumstances post Octane Fitness. But what we do have is Octane Fitness itself saying that we hold that an exceptional case is simply one that stands out from others with respect to the substantive strength of a party's litigating position or the unreasonable manner in which the case was litigated. Nothing about willfulness. This court in Fairwind Sailing described the relative substantive strength prong as going to whether there is an unusual discrepancy in the merits of the positions taken by the parties. No mention of willfulness whatsoever. It's not to say that this court needs to rule that willfulness.
But why couldn't willfulness be part? You heard us undoubtedly strongly challenging opposing counsel on the notion that willfulness could be conflated with making the case exceptional.
Correct, Your Honor.
But are you going to argue that willfulness can't be part of a totality analysis in order to find a case exceptional?
No, Your Honor, that's not our argument. But what you have to do is, to the extent you consider willfulness, not only do you have the fact that this was at best a very weak strain of willfulness permitted by the impermissibly lenient instruction, you have to consider willfulness in the context of the two prongs of the exceptional case test that this court outlined in Octane Fitness.
So can I just, getting a little away from willfulness, but sticking with the Octane Fitness, it says strength of case. And then we know that we're looking at totality of circumstances kind of after that. But totality of circumstances is designed to evaluate strength of case. Not parties to the case, not market capitalization of parties to the case. It feels like that analysis, although it's a totality of the circumstance, relates not to the parties to the case, but to the issues in the case. Is it your position that strength of case, that's right? Strength of case relates just to the issues and the claims and defenses? Or is it permissible to look, as the district court did, at kind of more factors as to who the parties were?
Your Honor, it is limited to the parties' litigating positions, and the district court cannot look outside that because the Supreme Court in Octane Fitness described this prong as the substantive strength of a party's litigating position, considering both the governing law and the facts of the case.
But and David and Goliath was impermissible.
Yes, Your Honor,
so it was impermissible. We should vacate and remand and tell him to do it over again. Tell the district court to do it over again without that impermissible consideration.
No, Your Honor, this court at a minimum should vacate, but it need not remand. And the reason, Your Honors, why this court can outright reverse the award of attorney's fees is because even though the district court did not apply the correct legal standard, the district court made numerous factual findings that easily negate the relative substantive strength prong of Octane Fitness. For example, Your Honor, at page A128 in the summary judgment order, the district court said, Nike presents strong legal arguments regarding Lantex's claim of trademark infringement, talking about likelihood of confusion. Then at page A133, talking about fair use, the district court said, Nike makes important legal arguments on this issue. Getting to the JMAL ruling at page A33, the district court, although denying JMAL, says that Lantex's evidence
is proceeding under the wrong legal standard, counsel. I don't see how we can say, well, these fact findings we'll accept, but the other fact findings we won't accept, but because they were under the wrong. I mean, it seems the natural course there is to just apply the right legal standard.
Yeah, usually the law is when the standard for remand is when an error of law is laid bare. I think this is Frankfurter. When error of law is laid bare, remand is the proper course.
Your Honor, that is ordinarily the proper course, and that is the minimum relief that should be granted. However, here, a remand would not be necessary because you have all of the factual findings from the district court already saying that Lantex's evidence of likelihood of confusion was not overwhelming. The jury's verdict on damages was a resounding rejection, and that is enough to support an outright reversal.
So you're against remand there. I assume you're also against remand to clarify disgorgement.
Correct, Your Honor. So on disgorgement, first of all, the district court did exercise its independent discretion and make independent findings. And we see that throughout its discussion where, for example, at page 821, the court says, the court finds that on the whole, the Banjo Buddies factors favor non-disgorgement. And then goes on addressing three of the factors, saying no evidence that Nike intended to confuse or deceive anyone, no evidence that sales were diverted from Lontex to Nike.
Let me just tease that
out.
Yes,
Your Honor.
If it was an impermissible legal consideration at the disgorgement phase to look at what the jury did or didn't find, if that's impermissible as a matter of law, and the district court relied on that for not awarding disgorgement, why isn't remand appropriate there too?
Your Honor, for two reasons. One, so first of all, assuming there was that reliance, under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 39, the district court is entitled to rely on an advisory jury's verdict. And as this court held in the Hayes and Greenwood cases cited in our briefs, the court may accept or adopt the jury's findings in its discretion. And we see here the district court exercising discretion by, again, making all of these independent findings and referencing the jury's—
No sales diverted from Nike to Lontex, things like that.
Correct, Your Honor. Those were all independent findings. And also, Your Honor, as we explained in the briefing, even if there were any error, which there was not, Lontex invited that error, especially at page A1619, when it advocated that profits should be submitted to the jury. But your honors need not even reach that issue because we have enough of the district court's work and findings and exercise of discretion on this issue to know that even though the district court made statements that were giving due regard to the jury's advisory verdict, it was not simply blindly following that.
All right. We don't have any other questions. Do you want to wrap up?
Yes, Your Honors. So this court should reverse the denial of JMAL on fair use, and that would dispose of the entirety of the cross appeals. However, at a minimum, this court should grant JMAL on the willfulness issue as well as vacate the orders that were affected by that, and then at a minimum vacate and remand, if not outright reverse, the legally improper exceptional case ruling and fee award. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Panikowski. Thank you, Mr. Setlin. The court will take the matter under advisement.